Lord, this is your word, the word of God. It says so much. It's in print. It's right here. It's in our hands. It's a message from heaven because you love us. And we want understanding according to your word. So open our eyes and ears and hearts that we may receive and understand, obey, believe, and apply. In Jesus' name, amen. So we're now in chapter 36 of Job. And we have seen Bildad, we have seen Eliphaz and Zophar, Job's three friends, and they did come out initially to comfort Job. If you remember, for a week in the dump or wherever he was, they really didn't say much. They did come to comfort him. They just sat with him, which was kind of commendable. And then they started their discourses, of course, which rambled on and on and on for chapters and everything, and then they finally gone silent. Then Job went silent. Job had return arguments for each one of them and everything. And now Elihu begins his argument. He started back in chapter 32. And evidently he'd been listening while the other four were speaking. He'd been there a while. We find that out from chapter 32. And he just couldn't take it anymore. He'd been listening. He's the youngest guy of them all. And he started out there in chapter 32. And now he's a young man. He's the youngest of all these guys. He's very brash. You know, a young man who thinks he knows it all. He's got all this vigor and all this other stuff, and he believes he's a very spiritual guy, and the Lord speaks to him and all this. He thinks he's anointed. He thinks he's spiritual, and he thinks he's God's man of the hour with new revelation. And he says some correct things like Job's other friends do, but like I pointed out last week, he doesn't know God because I won't get ahead of myself. We'll see. He doesn't know God. He says some correct things, but he doesn't really know God. So Elihu continues to speak without saying a whole lot of value. It took him a long time to introduce himself. It takes him a long time to say anything important. It takes him even longer to say anything of value, really. He does say some good things. But reoccurred to me, on Sunday, we saw in Luke chapter 18, verse 9, it said that, "And he," that would be Jesus, "spake this parable unto certain that trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others." And I thought it was a real mouthful because the connection between those who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and those who despised others goes together. You're trusting in your own righteousness. It's my righteousness. It's because of me. You're going to end up looking down on other people. Whereas when your righteousness comes from the Lord, you can't because it comes from the Lord. It's not even your own. So if I credit myself for my great spiritual walk with God, then it's easy to despise you guys for your low level of walking with God. You know what I'm saying? Your low carnal walk with God, so to speak. So anyways, that describes Elihu. He thinks he's really special. He really does. So this third time, Elihu decides to show Job that he had spoken wrongly. "Job, you're a phony. And Job, you better change your mind." He misquotes Job a lot. He misunderstands Job, and he's actually less sympathetic than the other three guys are, even though he promised he would be more sympathetic. He's not more than the other three. There were three improper sayings that Elihu charged Job with, and he rebukes him in each case here. But it's not the case. Elihu accuses Job of representing religion as indifferent. Religion is an indifferent, unprofitable thing, which God commands for his own sake, not for ours. Wrong. Elihu argues that. He also accused Job of complaining that God is deaf to the cries of people, that he doesn't hear the cries of the oppressed. And he says that Job scoffs at God not showing favor to him because it took so long. It's taking so long for God to answer. Three strikes against him, and he doesn't know what he's really saying. So Elihu decided to show Job the true cause of the delay. "You've done something wrong." Like Job hasn't heard that before. Here we go again. "You've done something wrong. Job, you're arrogant. You don't trust God." None of these things are true. Elihu, Zophar, Bildad, and Eliphaz didn't understand that God is using Job to shut the mouth of Satan. Remember where we started back with that? He's using Job to shut Satan up. "So they all multiplieth words without knowledge." One of the things that Elihu has accused Job of. You have multiplied words without knowledge. We're going to see God toss that back kind of in Elihu's face a little bit. But if you remember, the book began with a scene in heaven that explains everything. Chapters 1 and 2, where we started out, Job suffering because God was contesting with Satan. We remember that. Job never knew it, neither did his friends, so they all struggled to explain the suffering from the perspective of their ignorance. How many times do we see that? People try to explain a situation or their cause from a perspective of real ignorance. I think it's called politics. Never mind. But until finally Job rests in nothing but faith in God's goodness and the hope of his redemption, which is should be us, hoping in his goodness, because he's faithful, he can't fail, and the promise of his redemption. That's just as good a promise. We know. He makes a promise. He can't break a promise. Anyway, God will redeem Job's trust. He will defend Job to a degree. If Job has said anything wrong, he's not going to defend that. But he does stand behind Job, and that's the message of the book. So there are no rational or even theological explanations for disaster and pain. The idea is trust God. Can we do that? People ask me all the time, why? What's the theological, what's the rational explanation for suffering? Well, God is trying to teach you something. He's trying to cause you to grow, to mature, to be strengthened. Why are we going through disasters? Why do we go through pains? You know what? The best answer is trust God. He does know. He does know. When I get to the end tonight, I think I'm going to answer some of those questions that I've just asked. But here, chapter 36, verse 1, Elihu also proceeded. He continues, and he said, "Suffer me a little or allow me, and I'll show thee that I have yet to speak on God's behalf. I'm God's man of the hour. I will fetch my knowledge from afar." You know what he's saying? My knowledge comes from way up there in heaven. I'm a direct channel, man. "And will ascribe righteousness to my maker, for truly my words shall not be false." Listen to this. "He that is perfect in knowledge is with thee." Now don't mistake that for meaning God. He means himself. Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, they all talked extensively to Job. And here, Elihu says, now let a guy who really understands speak up, because one who's perfect in knowledge is here. It's me. I mean, serious. So it took the Lord one chapter to talk about the creation of the universe in Genesis. One chapter, really. And here in Job, we have 35 chapters of what seems like endless debate. Now we could say, what a waste of time. And in a way, yes, but look at all the questions that came out. Look at all the understanding we now have of God, even if it was thrown out in a negative way to begin with or a wrong way that's been straightened out since, because we've gotten into it and we've discussed it and everything. So maybe we see this same ratio, though, in our own lives, too. In other words, how little time we spend really conversing with God about the majesty and the glory and the beauty of his character. Every week I stand up here and I tell everybody, you need to spend more time with the Lord. You need to spend more time with the Lord. And some of us could go, oh, I spent a lot of time with the Lord this week. But gee, I didn't really thank him a whole lot. Didn't talk about his majesty or his glory or his beauty a lot. I sort of complained and asked him for stuff. You know what I mean? And I think this is the ratio that I'm trying to describe here. 35 chapters of what seems like endless debate. And maybe it's the same ratio in our lives. In other words, we spend so little time in the Lord's presence talking about these wonderful things and the majesty, glory, the beauty of his character and his ways and his word versus how many endless hours we spend rambling on about our problems and things like that. You know, and he's still our Father, and he loves to hear from you. And if you're going to complain to anybody, complain to him. He understands. Complaining can become a sin, though, so be careful. But he still loves you. He loves you a whole lot. But we spend a lot of time rambling about our problems and our ideas and our trials and troubles. So anyways, verse 5. "Behold, God is mighty and despiseth not any," which is true. "He is mighty in strength and wisdom," true. "He preserveth not the life of the wicked, but giveth right to the poor." We could say, yeah. "He withdraweth not his eyes from the righteous, but with kings are they on the throne. Yea, he doth establish them forever, and they are exalted. And if they be bound in fetters and be holden in cords of affliction, then he showeth them their work and their transgressions that they have exceeded. He openeth also their ear to discipline and commandeth that they return from iniquity. If they obey and serve him, they shall spend their days in prosperity and their years in pleasures. Now, they'll reign and they'll rule and they'll prosper. Maybe. Not necessarily. I know some of the holiest, most blessed people in the world, they're not super prosperous in the world's eyes at all. They may be very prosperous in the Lord's eyes. And it says they spend their years in pleasures. That's not necessarily true. We're guaranteed the pleasures once we leave this planet, maybe not on this planet. But if they obey not, they shall perish by the sword, and they shall die without knowledge. And I have to kind of say maybe to that, because not even all the bad people are going to die by the sword, and not everybody will die without knowledge. But the hypocrites in heart heap up wrath. They cry not when he bindeth them. They die in youth, and their life is among the unclean. And sometimes, but here, this last part, what he's saying, but the hypocrites in heart heap up wrath. See, he's accusing Job of that. Job, you're a hypocrite, and you're suffering God's wrath. And look at this here. They die in youth, and their life is among the unclean. Now, he's hitting Job below the belt. Job lost 10 kids. This is a way of Elihu saying, Job, you haven't been righteous. You're a hypocrite. I'm going to hit you under the belt, and your kids died because of your sin. This is low. This is really low. So Elihu says, Job, if you want to be right with God, you'll rule and reign in prosperity. And that's not necessarily true. Prosperity according to God, maybe, but prosperity according to the world is a whole different thing. You could be the poorest guy on earth and still really prosper in God's eyes. I mean, he's going to make sure that you have food and everything, but he says too, if you don't obey or if you're hypocritical, you're going to feel his wrath. And eventually, yes, we've learned that Asaph went into the tabernacle. He went into the congregation of the Lord, and he saw the end of the wicked. The end of the wicked, not necessarily their life on earth. There are a lot of wicked people prospering on earth right now. But their end, they're going to feel his wrath in the end. And maybe that hasn't come yet. Maybe that's in the next life. Verse 15, he delivereth the poor at his affliction and openeth their ears in oppression. Even so would he have removed thee out of the strait into a broad place where there is no straitness, and that which should be set on thy table should be full of fatness. But thou hast fulfilled the judgment of the wicked. Judgment and justice take hold on thee. Because there is wrath, beware lest he take thee away with his stroke, then a great ransom cannot deliver thee. Will he esteem thy riches? No, not gold, nor all the forces of strength or might. Desire not the night when people are cut off in their place. Take heed, regard not iniquity, for this hast thou chosen rather than affliction. Behold, God exalteth by his power. Who teaches like him? So true. Who hath enjoined him his way? Or who can say, thou hast wrought iniquity? Who could ever tell God that he's done wrong? Remember that thou magnify his work which men behold. I like that phrase. Remember that you're a witness. You're an ambassador for God, that you can magnify here his work which men behold. Think about that. By our conduct. I remember sharing at a marriage retreat and saying, your marriage can serve in a way that people can get saved by observing you. You can magnify the Lord in so many ways. You can glorify the Lord, and you can become such a witness. And he says, every man may see it. Man may behold it afar off. Behold, God is great, and we know him not. Neither can the number of his years be searched out. That's true. I mean, he's infinite. He has no beginning. He has no end. He lives outside of time. But we can know him. We can know him. We can. So anyways, all of this is a truthful, powerful argument, but it's based here really on Eliphaz's assumption that Job has to do this because of his great transgression against God. That's why you better do all this stuff. It's a powerful, good principle, but it's wrongly applied to Job's situation. And as Elihu talks about God's greatness and how he's way beyond our understanding, which is true, evidently, at this moment, there's a change in the climate. Here, the clouds start rolling in. The winds begin to blow. Maybe it's beginning to rain. But you know what I find, too, is God's coming. I like this. He's going to take what he sees and use it and apply it in his teaching or his discourse here. It says, for he makes small the drops of water. They pour down rain according to the vapor thereof, which the clouds do drop and distill upon man abundantly. Vapor. That word vapor is in the word evaporation. We know that water will be on the ground and it gets evaporated into the atmosphere. The vapor, it ends up in the clouds and everything that becomes small drops that grow bigger until the drops get fat enough that the updrafts can't keep it up in the air. And here they're writing about this how many thousands and thousands and thousands of years before scientists could actually validate this. So the small drops grow bigger, they can't be upheld by the updrafts, and they fall as rain. And here he is describing this meteorologically, and how long did it take them to really figure this out, scientists? So anyways, verse 29, also, can any understand the spreadings of the clouds? Do you guys ever look at how many different kinds of clouds there are? It's amazing, isn't it? Big, fluffy ones, high ones that are rigid, some that look like, I don't know what, but how do you explain how they get spread out? How do they stay up in the air? Man can't figure these things out, really. Or the noise of his tabernacle. How about when you were a kid and you heard just a thunder crack right over your head? Did that freak you out or what? I remember one day, Joe and I, when we were in Canada, we just cut this guy's yard. We're coming home, both of us on the same bike. He's on the handlebars. And I swear, I thought lightning was going to nail us, and the thunder hit right over our head. It sounded like, I felt like whatever hair I had, it's always standing on end, okay? But the hair on my arms went up in the air, you know what I mean? So all this here, the noise of his tabernacle, and can any understand it? No, the answer is no, because they still don't completely understand weather, do they? How many of you have a weather app? How right is it? I don't even look at it anymore. I don't bother with it. They can't completely understand the weather, but the words noise and tabernacle aren't the usual words that are used here. This means very sudden and in a special layer. Why? You know, it's almost as if these things are in a special place, in a special den, like where they hide, where they go to be exclusive or whatever, and suddenly in a special lair. It says, behold, he spreadeth his light upon it and covereth the bottom of the sea. For by them judgeth he the people. He giveth meat in abundance. With clouds he covereth the light and commandeth it not to shine by the cloud that come betwixt. The noise thereof showeth concerning it, the cattle also concerning the vapor. He's talking about natural phenomena and the things that are happening all around him. He's trying to explain it. I like this last phrase here. The noise thereof showeth it concerning the cattle, also concerning the vapor. You know, my grandmother used to say, hey, if all the cows are laying down, it means it's going to rain. So the cattle had some kind of idea here, you know. And I don't know whether that was true. I used to see them in the pouring rain standing and the pouring rain sitting down, you know. It's up to the cow, right? So, drawing from surroundings here, Elihu uses the storm to speak not only of God, but God's awesome power and his abundant provision, too. And I give Elihu credit for using the things around him, for using the things all around him in his teaching. I don't know how many of you have taught Sunday school before. Looks like quite a few, but anyways, the things you gather up. You know, like Katie's always gathering little things for her class to bring in, to show the kids, to make application. I used to do that galore. Bring in things from nature, bring in things from science, bring in all kinds of things so they could see. I like how he uses these things. I heard some pastors that this is a little offbeat, but using things as they come to teach things around them. One guy was doing a wedding, and you know where they take the two candles and they light the one in the middle, you know, and now we're one. And well, the breeze came through. You guys could appreciate this. A breeze came through the church, and the bride's veil went into a candle and came back, and it's, and the groom took it off and threw it on the ground, and he stamped on it. And the pastor, without missing a beat, says, praying that the Holy Spirit ignites your love, and, you know, and just, it just, you know, right into the next, you know. And then there was another church where a guy, he says, I was doing a wedding, and all the bridal party, all the guys and all the girls were born again. The couple was born again, except for the one girl on the very end. She wasn't born again. She had told the bride, I'm never going to your church, and I'm never getting baptized in that little pond they got there. I don't like that idea. So she said that. Well, during the ceremony, she had to walk through, and it was real hot, and she passed out, and she fell into the water. And he said, you know, sometimes you put God to the test. And he said, you know, he just rolled with it. Anyway, the girl ended up getting saved, but he used the whole thing like, he said something like, you know, marriage, when you plunge into marriage, you have to expect the unexpected, using the things around him. And then one other guy had done a communion at a wedding, and the guy had all these doubts. I don't know, before the ceremony. And the pastor took him aside and said, you know she's the one. It was his buddy. We sat together with all the scriptures, and you know she's the one. Yeah. I just have so many doubts. I just can't help it. So then when they were up at the altar and everything, they were doing the communion, and the pastor said, this never happened to me before, but I go to take the thing with the elements on it, and there's nothing there. No bread, no wine. So he just rolls with it, and he says, sometimes we have to walk by faith and not by sight. You know? And there's nothing there to do communion with. And the groom's looking at him like, I knew this wasn't right. You know. But anyways, having said all that, we're visual learners most of all, but I love those little stories how they just kind of roll right with it and you know, use the things that are going on, the things around him. He does do that, which I think is great because Jesus was the master at doing this. When we go through the Gospels, I mean, nobody was better at this method, of course. He talked about rocks. He talked about the lilies of the field, the trees, sowing seed, all these different things like that, sparrows. So this is a good method. So be encouraged to utilize what's taking place around you, or maybe the things around you, maybe the things in nature and that when you're sharing with people, and use what's at hand to draw people's attention to the glory and the goodness of the Lord. Chapter 37, at this also my heart trembleth and is moved out of his place. Hear attentively the noise of his voice and the sound that goeth out of his mouth. He directeth it under the whole heaven, and his lightning under the ends of the earth. After it a voice roareth. He thundereth with the voice of his excellency, and he will not stay them when his voice is heard. God thundereth marvelously with his voice. Great things doeth he which we cannot comprehend. True. So Elihu felt that Job needed a good dose of the greatness of God. So he's given it to him, you know. And it's more good advice that's wrongly applied to Job's situation, really. But Elihu does rightly understand that the mighty sound of thunder, it seems like God's voice sometimes. Do you ever have a crack of thunder hit right at the right time? I remember we were doing something in Canada, and I was right in the middle of a teaching, and I said something about the power of God, and all of a sudden, and everybody's sitting there is kind of like laughing, and I said, see? And it was just so perfect. But, I mean, how these things can happen. But it does, you know. Thunder seems to man like the voice of God, doesn't it? I always thought it was the angels bowling. That's what my grandmother, that's another thing she told me too. But for he saith to the snow, be thou on the earth. You know what? If God gives a command to anything, it does it. Be thou on the earth. Likewise to the small rain and to the great rain of his strength. He gives commands. He sealeth up the hand of every man, that all men may know his work. He can stop you, that you may know what he's doing. He may stop you from your plans and your ideas and, you know, whatever it might be, to show you what he's doing. He sealeth up the hand of every man, that we may know his work. Then the beasts go into dens and remain in their places. Out of the south cometh the whirlwind, and cold out of the north. By the breath of God, frost is given, and the breath of the waters is straightened. Also by watering, he wearieth the thick cloud, and scattereth his bright cloud. So this is figurative language here about the meteorology is correct. So many people think this was written centuries later. They would read the Bible and say this had to be written centuries later because scientists found these things out and said, how could they know this? Well, they did. And science has verified this in much later time, but the drops of water in the clouds are again held aloft by these updrafts of wind. So when they're too heavy or watered, here's the word, they get wearied, is the other word, and they fall. So the water becoming precipitation, listen, in the atmosphere is also enabled by bright electrical charges, too. It also helps so that, you know, you have lightning, then thunder, then rain, then snow. But the atmosphere is charged by the electricity that helps form these droplets and things like that as well. Verse 12, and it is turned around about by his counsels. In other words, the Hebrew word counsels here is his steering, as if he's driving it, he's herding it, or whatever, that they may do whatsoever he commandeth upon the face of the world and the earth. So here Elihu continues his wonderful speech, I'm sure, at least in his opinion, and it's way too long, obviously. But he continues on about the awesome power of God as seen in this storm all around them. God steers. Listen, this is great, though, too. He steers storms for correction, for cleansing, for nourishment, an answer of prayer, like farmers. How many farmers were just praying for this rain we just had? I'm sure, but they do. He uses these storms, steers them for all kinds of reasons. Maybe he wants to correct an area, or cleanse an area, or water an area, or whatever it might be. Purify. He alludes to the rain, the clouds, the thunder, the lightning like this, using the things around him to draw the attention to God, which is a great idea. Verse 13, he causeth it to come whether for correction, and here it is, or for his land, or for mercy. Hearken unto this, O Job. Stand still and consider the wondrous works of God. Do that sometime. Stand still and consider the wondrous works of God. Stand still and know that I'm God. Be still and know that I'm God. Be still and take a day in. You know, look at the sky. Last night I was out looking at the stars and the moon, and I've been doing that. I do that a lot. I love looking at the night sky. I mean, you just take all this in. It's such a great idea. Use these things around us to draw attention to God. It's a good idea. He causeth it to come, whether for correction or for his land or for mercy. Hearken unto this, O Job, stand still and consider the wondrous works of God. Dost thou know when God disposed them and caused the light of his cloud to shine? Again, the water cycle information at this time is amazing. It's been studied ever since. It's been studied in detail to find out what they already knew here. So, of course, there's so much to know that weather forecasting is largely statistical. They base it a lot on statistics now. They don't really know what's coming. That's why they're so wrong. It's become just as much art as it is science these days. He says, dost thou know the balancing of the clouds? How do they float? They're heavier than air. How do they float? The wondrous works of him, which is perfect in knowledge. How thy garments are warm. You ever think of that? Just the concepts of physics and chemistry and biology and so on that are woven into our everyday life we don't think of. Like, if we take an atom, a regular atom, it's so tiny you can't see it. But it has positive particles, negative particles, and particles are spinning around the nucleus. There's billions of those in you. But you know what? If you took that atom and blew it up to the size of our solar system, the particles would be farther apart than the planets are. In other words, you're a lot of space. Matter has a lot of space in it. That's why we're space cadets. Think about that. But anyways, really, it's amazing the way the particles don't fly away. They don't fly off. Yesterday in our devotions at home, I was saying, how come we're not a foot further out into space so we freeze, or a foot further toward the sun so we burn up? How come? What keeps us there? I mean, according to the scientists today, it's luck. Yeah. Colossians tells us that it's the Lord. He keeps all things together. He goes on here, and when he quieteth the earth by the south wind, hast thou with him spread out the sky, which is strong and is a molten looking glass. You ever look at the sky and it looks like it's on fire? Or it's just so smooth? Candy and I get into watching the sunset, you know, and if you're here, right here at church, right there, the sky is awesome, you know, and so we have to drive home going right at it. It's kind of cool. But he says here, teach us what we shall say unto him, for we cannot order our speech by reason of darkness. What can we say to the Lord? He's so smart. He thinks we're puny little imbeciles. Why would we bother even to speak to him? Job, you tell us what to say to God. And you know what? I know God well enough to know you can tell him anything. God, I'm stupid. I need your help. I mean, you could say that. You could. Lord, I'm a dummy. I need wisdom. Lord, I'm a sinner. I need forgiveness. So teach us. I mean, we don't know what to say. So in order to prove the limits of Job's knowledge, Elihu asks a bunch of questions about natural phenomena. And soon, God's going to do the same thing. But the big difference, though, is God knows all the answers, doesn't he? Elihu doesn't. Verse 20 says, "Shall it be told him that I speak?" Why would you bother to tell him that I'm speaking? I don't think he's going to listen anyway. "If a man speaks, surely he shall be swallowed up." In other words, if I approach God, won't he just swallow me up? "And now men see not the bright light which is in the clouds, but the wind passeth and cleanseth them. Fair weather cometh out of the north with God his terrible majesty." This is awesome because listen to this. The word for fair weather is zahab. And zahab, really, it's used more than 175 times in the Old Testament. But in every other instance except here, it's translated gold. Interesting. So it says, "Gold cometh out of the north," which probably refers to the aurora borealis. You ever seen the northern lights? If you go up to Candy's hometown, it's really easy to see them so far up north, right? Well, the aurora borealis and God's terrible majesty. Terrible, the word terrible is become terrible. It means it's worthy of awe. It means it's awesome. It means it's worthy of reverence and respect and admiration. That's what it means, terrible. You know, we use it to think of terror, horrible. Well, it means awesome and worthy of respect or admiration. And it is, if you've ever seen the northern lights and stuff. 23, I like this verse too. "Touching the Almighty, we cannot find him out." We're going to be spending eternity learning about God. Because he is immeasurable. He is immutable. He is just, think about it. He's eternal. He's past finding out. "Touching the Almighty, we cannot find him out. He is excellent in power and in judgment and in plenty of justice. He will not afflict." In other words, he won't destroy us. He has judgment and justice. He won't afflict us. He won't destroy us just because he wants to. "Men do therefore fear him. He respecteth not any that are wise of heart." You know what that is? Proud. He doesn't respect you for being proud. What do you have to be proud of? You know, really, we could take Jeremiah's words and say the only thing you can be proud of is that you know God. That's it. That's a lot. That's everything. It's great. But Elihu declares that God is so great that he's past finding out. And with that, he ends his speech. Chapters 1 and 2 dealt with Job's dilemma, right? Chapters 3 through 37 dealt with Job's debates. Chapters 38 through 42, we're going to see, they deal with Job's deliverance. Now, Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, all of them, all said that God was disciplining Job. Job just thought that God wanted to destroy him, though. That's it. So Eliphaz, he made his case approaching God through personal experience way back there, an observation. Bildad made his case by approaching God through philosophy and kind of the tradition of the fathers. Zophar made his case by approaching Job with a diagnosis. You know, an analysis type thing. Like, a lot of people want to do that today. I'm gonna analyze you, brother, you know, and things like that. And he tried to analyze Job's condition by education. And then we have Elihu. He says by way too many words that God sought to direct him through revelation. Through revelation is God directing me and instructing me and using me. In Genesis 1:1, all of creation was described in 10 words. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. So as we know, as we've seen, all five of them are incorrect, and we're going to see that again. In chapter 38, all the debates are over. This is my favorite part of the book. I'm so glad we make it here. We're only going to do chapter 38. But in chapter 38, all the debates are over. Why? Because God's coming. And that's the one thing we can look forward to. God's coming. He is. So Job has been waiting for God to answer, and finally God comes. But notice that he comes as the answer. He doesn't have to answer these puny men's questions. He doesn't have to. You notice he's going to start right off asking a whole lot of his own questions. I'm not going to answer you guys. You guys answer my questions. I am the answer, is what God's saying. So the peace he brings doesn't come from understanding. It supersedes, it passes, transcends, and surpasses all understanding. And it's still true. So he brings the peace that he has. The peace he brings doesn't come from understanding. This is still true. And we may never have an answer for many of the questions that are stirring among us. A lot of the questions right now that you have, maybe they're not answered. God isn't answering. He hasn't answered. Maybe he isn't going to answer. You know, I remember Pastor Chuck teaching that I've been alive for a long time, and I've been asking God this question for many years, and he still hasn't answered me. And I think his question's answered now, because he's right there next to Jesus, I'm sure. But we'll find that God himself is the answer, and it'll give us a peace that passes understanding. So look at verse 1. So then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind, no, out of the storm that's there. Don't ask me to describe this or explain this. I don't know. He spoke out of a bush. You know, I mean, he's how many ways out of a pillar of fire, a cloud? You know, God can manifest himself in any way that he wants to. No one has truly seen God the way that he is. That's why Jesus came here to show us what God was like. Of course, we still haven't seen God in his pure form and everything, but the wind's blowing, the storm's brewing, and the Lord came to Job and spoke to him at the time of the storm. How often is that true? That we think that God won't speak to us, he won't answer me, but he puts a storm in your life, and all of a sudden he's talking to you. You know what I mean? In the storm, because you're seeking him in the storm. And how true is that? The disciples, they were struggling on the Galilee as a storm nailed them. And even though they're experienced fishermen, they were afraid. They were scared. They're out in the Galilee, and this storm must have been a real doozy because they're afraid they're about to die. And just then, the Lord appears to them in the storm, walking on the water. And the first thing they think is, here comes a ghost. They had a tradition that before you were going to drown, a ghost came to you. They really did. They had this tradition. So evidently, Jesus knows the tradition, and he freaked them out. He comes across the water, and they think he's a ghost. No, it's me. It's me. I like that, though. He said, be of good cheer. It is I. Fear not. I love the way he does that. Matthew 14, fear not. Jesus came to his disciples in the storm, and haven't you found over and over and over again, this is true, that he comes to us in the storm as well? When things are difficult, and they're challenging, and you're really on your knees because they're shaking, things are really tough. It seems like he draws to us in some profound way, in a special way. How many times have we found that to be true? Well, he answered out of the whirlwind, and he said, who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? And he's not talking about Job. He's talking about Elihu. If you remember, Elihu claimed that Job spoke without knowledge. Well, here's God, and the first thing he says is, who is this that speaks without knowledge? And I think I ended last week saying, this dude doesn't know God because God says, I don't know you. That's scary. What does the Lord tell us in Matthew that I may say to some, I never knew you because I didn't know you. He's saying, I don't know this guy. So Jesus came to his disciples in the storm, and here he's answering out of the whirlwind. Who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? To paraphrase, who's this knucklehead who doesn't have a clue what he's talking about? I mean, basically, right? Elihu. How would you like to be greeted by God like that? But look at what he says. Gird up now thy loins like a man. I love this. See, Jesus would make a good coach. God says, get up. You know, and I believe that our Father would come to many of us pouting. We're all comfortable. We're spoiled little children. And I think he'd say the same thing. Get up. Stop. Grow up. In a loving way, lovingly, not chiding, you know, not anger, but being real. It's time to get up. It's time to get going. It's time to, you know, your comfort zone's about this big, America. If it's too hot, it's too cold, it's too this, it's too that, you get it outside of this, you guys are so uncomfortable. Ugh, get up, you know? I mean, think about it. I think he'd say the same thing. He says, "For I will demand of thee and answer thou me." Job, you've been questioning, and all you other guys have wasted a whole lot of breath for way too long, like 35 chapters. So now I have some questions for you, and he sure does. So God's going to ask Job about 70 questions before he's through. It's quite a dialogue, isn't it? He says, "Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding. Where were you when I was doing this? Were you there? I don't remember seeing you anywhere." You think about this. Humans think they know so much about science. And there's endless theories and hypotheses. But here, you know, the Lord shows up and says, "What do you know firsthand? What do you know all by yourself? What do you really know? If I took all the knowledge of humankind and added it up, it'd fit in a thimble, at least one of God's thimbles." He says, "Who hath laid the measures thereof?" Who can measure my creation? Who can measure the earth? Who can measure any of the things that I've really made? You know, today I guess they can measure the earth and all that, but how long did it take them before they could figure that all out? Who laid the measures thereof, if thou knowest, or who hath stretched a line or a measure upon it? Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened? It's not on the back of a giant tortoise. Atlas isn't holding it up in the air. There's all kinds of theories. Or who hath laid the cornerstone thereof? So God starts out asking Job, "Where were you when I designed the earth? Do you have understanding of the underpinnings, the foundations, the history?" And we think we have the understanding of geography or geology and paleontology and all kinds of other ologies. And we think we have it all cleared up, but in reality, we really don't know very much. He says, "When the morning stars sang together, all the sons of God shouted for joy." You know what morning stars are here? And sons of God refers to the angels. Think about this. This means that when God was creating the world, the angels were singing. So listen, God works really good with background music. So we should give him some background music, shouldn't we? When things seem chaotic and confusing and dark, I guess, think about it. In our lives, we should probably start singing too, because the Lord works really good with background music going on. Depression and discouragement could be done away with if we would put on the garment of praise for the spirit of heaviness. You ever just start worshiping, singing? I turn the stereo on in our house all the time. I've got music somewhere all the time. And it lightens your mood. It changes. And if it's Christian music too, because the music, it better be steered at the Lord. It better be glorifying. It better be praising the Lord. It's going to lift you up. But we forget about that. Start singing. Sing to him. You know, when you're singing those words and your favorite Christian radio station's on, listen to what you're saying. Make sure you're not saying anything wrong. But listen to what you're saying and then do it again and mean it. So depression, discouragement would all go away if we'd put on that garment of praise for the spirit of heaviness. So sing songs of praise and watch God create something wondrous out of the darkness. He says in verse 8, "Or who shut up the sea with doors when it brake forth as it had issued out of the womb?" At the great flood. He's referring to that. Listen, Genesis 7:11 says the foundation of the great deep were broken up. In other words, the deep, the water in the earth broke out. The springs ruptured and the water came up through the earth. It didn't just rain down on the earth. The water came up out of the earth. There's enough water in and on the earth that we could cover the entire earth, I think, 7 times, they say. And there is a trench, I forget what it's so deep, it's like 6 miles deep in the ocean, which is already at least a mile down. It would take an hour for a stone to fall to the bottom of that, the Mariana Trench. He goes on here, again, so it's not just the windows of heaven being opened. The fountains of the great deep were broken up. God says, "When I made the cloud, the garment thereof, and thick darkness, a swaddling band for it." This probably, listen to this, this alludes to the water canopy that was all around the earth. If you could picture the earth as a ball spinning there in space, there was a water canopy covering the whole thing, a layer of water circling the whole globe, so that when the sun hit that layer of water, it caused a greenhouse effect inside the water, inside the canopy, which meant that the whole globe was a tropical atmosphere. That's why we can explain vegetation and palm trees under the poles if we were to dig them up and everything. So it surrounded the planet before the flood, and evidently this water canopy in the atmosphere provided protection from the harmful rays of the sun. That's why the creatures got so big and the plants got so big. People lived longer. There wasn't radiation bombarding them and all that other stuff like that. So the harmful rays of the sun creating a greenhouse effect on the entire planet. And again, there was frozen, we can find frozen vegetation that only grows in the tropics under the poles, really, under the ice caps of the Arctic Circle. Anyways, verse 10, and break up for it my decreed place and set bars and doors and said, hitherto shalt thou come, but no further, and here shall thy proud waves be stayed. 5/7 of our planet is covered by water. I know it doesn't look like it when you look at a globe or something, but 5/7 of the planet's covered by water. He says, where were you when I put the boundaries upon the oceans? So God asks Job in verse 12, hast thou commanded the morning since thy days and caused the dayspring to know his place? Do you cause the sun to rise every morning, Job? Is that your job? Is it not amazing that the sun rises every day and sets every day? If we think about it, we take it for granted because it's just always happened. But think about that. He says that it might take hold of the ends of the earth, that the wicked might be shaken out of it. It is turned as clay to the seal, and they stand as a garment. See, he's saying the earth turns like a cylinder. They used to make these clay cylinders, and they put writing on them. And they'd spin them so you could see all sides, so you could read it. You know, I mean, a cylinder with writing. And he's saying the earth does this. How does he know? Well, this is God saying it. But, I mean, it's written in his word, and how old is this? You know what I'm saying? I mean, so he's saying the earth turns like a cylinder, and from the wicked their light is withholden, and the high arm shall be broken. Hast thou entered into the springs of the sea? You know, it wasn't that long ago they discovered that down at the bottom of the ocean they found springs. Now, you have to think about this. How long did it take them to get down there to find it? It was always in here. Or hast thou walked in the search of the depth? Have the gates of death been opened unto thee, or hast thou seen the doors of the shadow of death? You guys remember back in chapter 3, in Job chapter 3, if you remember, he said, why didn't I die when I was born? Then I would have been at rest, and then I wouldn't have been at peace. And you know what? Well, God asked him, do you really know what's beyond life? You know, do you really know what waits for you in the next realm and all that? He asks. He says, has thou perceived the breadth of the earth? Declare if thou knowest it all, if you know the measurements. Where is the way where light dwelleth? And as for darkness, where is the place thereof? That thou shouldest take it to the bound thereof, and that thou shouldest know what the paths to the house thereof. Knowest thou it because thou wast then born, or because the number of thy days is great? One of the things God asks here, I like this. Where does the darkness go when the light comes, Job? You know, actually, darkness is the absence of light. Light is a created thing. Darkness is just the absence of light. But he's saying, where does it go? And answer me. He says, has thou entered into the treasures of the snow? Think of this. Billions of snowflakes fall every year. And the geometric design of every single one of them is different. You try this. Cut out a billion snowflakes and try to make them all different. I mean, they just are. It's amazing, isn't it? The intricacy, the beauty is amazing that no two are alike. You know, the snow on the mountains of desert regions is considered white gold. Every year in Israel, Mount Hermon, or in Saudi Arabia, the mountains that are high enough, they pray that there gets snow on top of those mountains because when it melts, it comes down. That's the water they drink. So it's considered white gold. You know, to say there are treasures of the snow, I think, is just a term that he's using. I don't think he has snow treasured all up someplace. He could create it in an instant. But he will use it in the future, too. I was reading the other day where Israel is offering water to Iran. They have a water problem. There's a water problem over there, and Israel is offering them water. And Iran wants to turn it down. Israel is the number one technologically using recycled water, desalinating water, you know, taking the salt out of it and everything. They're masters at this. They're never going to run out of water. But Iran wants to turn them down. Now, Turkey is saying that we have natural water because we have so many mountains, and the snow on the mountains, it melts and it comes down into our fresh water system, and we have so much water, you don't need their water. But you know what? I have the idea that if God wants to, Turkey ain't going to have no water, you know, especially what's going on in Turkey right now. That guy's kind of a nut. Well, back to here to verse 22, he says, "Or hast thou seen the treasures of the hail, which I have reserved against the time of trouble, against the day of battle and war?" This is interesting because God says snow and hail will be used in times of war. And have they been? Yeah, actually, snow killed Napoleon's invasion of Russia. He had all these plans, and he really could have done it because all he was going to do was fight a few hundred thousand farmers with hoes and shovels. And he's going to go in there, and he's going to take them out. He's going to take over Russia, but didn't happen. It killed his invasion, all the snow. So, and prophetically, hailstones that weigh more than 100 pounds are going to hammer the earth. We read about that during the tribulation period. We read about that in Revelation. Recently, a 200-pound chunk of ice fell out of the sky and absolutely destroyed a house like it was hit by a bomb. Imagine a bowling ball falling from the sky, the damage that it would do. Imagine a 100-pound hailstone. Well, when they sifted through the wreckage and they took this huge chunk of ice out of the house, they discovered that it had come from a plane. And it froze in its waste tank in the plane, and it fell. So, yeah, use your imagination. It wasn't pretty. So, I mean, you could just imagine. Anyway, moving on. Verse 24, "By what way is the light parted?" I like that word parted. It means diffused. We know light can be separated, but we don't know how, because to this day we're not sure whether light is a wave or a particle. And he mentions parted here. They argue about that. I think it's both, actually. "Which scattereth the east wind upon the earth, who hath divided a watercourse for the overflowing of waters, or a way for the lightning of thunder," or the thunderbolt, "to cause it to rain on the earth where no man is, on the wilderness wherein there is no man, to satisfy the desolate and waste ground, and to cause the bud of the tender herb to spring forth." God knows all this. "Hath the rain a father? Or who hath begotten the drops of dew? Out of whose womb came the ice and the hoary frost of heaven? Who hath gendered it? The waters are hid as with a stone, and the face of the deep is frozen." You know, and again, these guys have to take this for God's word. They're southern boys. They probably have never seen ice ever. And they're getting all this teaching about ice here. He says, "Canst thou bind the sweet influences of the Pleiades, or loose the bands of Orion?" Now, the Pleiades are thought to be the center of the gravitational force of the Milky Way. The very center, okay? The Milky Way galaxy. This seems to allude to that. Now, sweet influences, it's only used here. It means clusters here. And Pleiades was formerly known as the Seven Sisters constellation. So they thought there were only seven stars there, right? It's now known to be a huge cluster. So isn't it interesting that that word is used? Orion's stars aren't bound up, actually. And since we recently have made stronger telescopes, we know that. They're not bound up. They're pretty spread out. He says, "Canst thou bring forth Maseroth in his season? And canst thou guide Arcturus with his suns?" Now, Arcturus is called the runaway star. It moves very quickly. It moves 125,000 miles per second. That's pretty amazing. Now, our closest star, obviously the sun, could fit 1,300,000 Earths inside of it. That's how big it is. But our sun is puny compared to Antares. Antares could hold 64 of our suns. But in the constellation Hercules, there's a star that can hold 100 million Antares, which can hold 64 suns, which could hold 1,300,000 Earths. So that's pretty big. but there's an even bigger star called Epsilon that can hold 1 to 2 million Antares. That's amazing. And God created all of it, and he guides the whole thing too. Verse 33, knowest thou the ordinances of heaven? Canst thou set the dominion thereof in the earth? Canst thou lift up thy voice to the clouds, that abundance of waters may cover thee? Can you cause something as simple as rain, Job? They're trying, scientists are trying to control the weather. And you know what their number one reason for it is? War. As a weapon, if they can create hailstorms, thunder and lightning storms, or floods and so on, or number one, you'd think it would be agriculture, you know, or just plain pleasure of nice weather, but no. So can you cause something as simple as rain, Job? Canst thou send lightnings that they may go and say unto thee, here we are? Do you know how amazing it is that we can use electrical currents? You ever think of that? You ever look at all the wires outside and think there's stuff running through it? We can do that? Or how about wireless stuff now? You ever think of what's going flying through the air? Radio waves and things, and we can use electrical currents. How come? Because God has given us the understanding. Look, who hath put wisdom in the inner parts? For any of it, God did. Or who hath given understanding to the heart? God gives us the understanding. How did we ever figure this out? You know, scientists even want to say, well, aliens came here in past civilizations and they taught us this. Really? All right. If they were aliens, they were demons. That's what I say. God gives us great understanding, but also he speaks of instincts too. You know, he's going to go on and talk a lot about the animals. This morning I was telling Candy that they did this study, which fascinates me because last summer, every time I sat down at my desk to study, I have a window right here as I'm studying at home. Right here on our gutter, a crow came every time I was studying and landed there, right over my head. And he made a lot of noise, and he jumped up and down in the gutter. And I thought, this is spiritual. So I got my pellet gun out. And Ray Andrews told me, too. Ray lives about 300 yards straight back behind me. He said that on all these trees right here, there's just this family of crows. Well, we took care of that. I got one right as it took off. I got one, and I put it in the middle of the yard where all the other crows could see it, and they didn't come around for a long time. Ray said he was doing the same thing. But Ray goes, do you know how smart crows are? Well, this morning, I did some research. I told Candy this. I said they found out that the scarecrow doesn't scare the crow. Doesn't do anything. You guys have probably noticed this. And a guy wanted to figure out what it was all about. So he set up a scarecrow, and he watched from really far away. The crows came anyways. So he set up a blind near the scarecrow, and the crows didn't come. So he thought, that's because I'm so close. So what he did was two guys went into the blind, and one came out. And the crows still wouldn't go near the scarecrow. Listen, they did this all the way up to about 50. Crows can count because the crows kept away. You know, they were trying to fool the crows. They'd put 10 guys in there, send 9 home. One guy stayed in there. The crows wouldn't go for this. They knew. So the whole study came to the conclusion, crows can count. And another thing I learned, you ever hear of the bird, the tern? The Nordic tern. This bird lays its eggs, I think, in Antarctica, and it flies 1,000 miles away to another land, probably somewhere up in Canada. But when that egg hatches, that baby, as soon as it can fly, goes and finds its parents, right to them. The penguin, that was another one. The female lays the egg and books. She just takes off. And the male stands over the egg. So when you see those pictures of all those penguins just standing there, those are all guys. You could tell because they're all wearing tuxedos. They're all standing over the egg, and the wife goes away, and they mate for life. One mate, and the wife goes away for 2 to 3 months. She comes back, and she goes right to the mate. She knows where it is. Anyways, how does all this happen? So instincts, another thing. He gives us understanding. He gives the animal instincts. And he says, can you really know God through creation? And I believe that God's making it real clear to Job that creation reveals his greatness. They're all part of a magnificent design by a magnificent creator. And we can know about God through his creation, but creation won't bring a man to the saving knowledge of God, will it? The Apostle Paul writes in Romans 1:20, listen, this was part of our devotion the other day, for the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen. We can see it. Being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. He's saying that if you observe nature, you have to come to the conclusion that somebody created this. So if you're not, you're just stubborn, you're ignorant, you're stupid. I mean, you're just so proud, you won't accept it. That nature is enough to realize there's a creator. It's true. So he says they are without excuse. So verse 37 here, well, who can number the clouds in wisdom? Or who can stay the bottles or the clouds? He calls them bottles because they can hold moisture, right? The clouds of heaven, the bottles of heaven. When the dust grows into hardness and the clods cleave fast together, wilt thou hunt the prey for the lion or fill the appetite of the young lions? When they couch, or literally it should probably say crouch in their dens, and abide in the covert to lie in wait. Who provideth for the raven his food when his young ones cry unto God? They wander for lack of meat. So the raven is an unclean animal, as we know. But who takes care of him? And what God means by this is everything that every animal needs to survive is on this planet. God did that. But Job's asking God questions. But when God comes here, he doesn't give Job any answers, does he? Because God asks Job questions. And why does he do that? Because God, our Father, isn't necessarily one who gives the answers as much as he is the answer. He doesn't have to answer, really. He is the answer. You know, we all want to know reasons why in life these events happen, these situations happen in our lives, the problems happen, the disasters happen, or whatever they are. And really, when you think about it, God's one who doesn't always answer our questions. And we have it in our heart, in our mind, that he must answer my question. Why? He doesn't have to. He doesn't have to. See, we have to think about that. Is he mean? Is he proud? Is he a jerk? No, none of those. None of those. That's not it at all. You know, and so again, he's the answer in our situation. He doesn't have to answer the questions. Have you ever had kids ask you unanswerable questions? Kids, man, when I was in Sunday school, they asked me, what did Noah do with the termites? I mean, they would come up with questions that were amazing. You know what I'm saying? I mean, they would ask all kinds of unanswerable questions. What's the shape of pink? What? What's the shape of pink? Well, it isn't a shape, it's a color. Could you picture a little girl saying, what's the shape of pink? It's not a shape, it's a color. But they'll ask you again until you find an answer, won't they? They'll ask and ask and ask until you come up with some kind of an answer, won't they? And it's unanswerable. And as much as we want to, we can't answer the question. It's unanswerable. But I believe that we often ask questions that can't be answered this side of heaven. Because we're like kids who are all goofed up. Actually, listen, we are. We ask the wrong questions. We ask the wrong questions. We're limited in ability to analyze these situations. And the Lord would say to us that it's not answers that we want, but it's his presence that we need. Sometimes I won't answer your questions because I like your presence. If I answer your question, you won't come back. You know? And maybe that's it too. Maybe we're asking the wrong questions, but he knows that what we really need is his presence. And the questions should drive us there to be in his presence. The good news, though, he's here right now. He's a prayer away. He's a prayer away from you on your couch. Or instead of watching TV, go in the other room and he's a prayer away. He's right there. You can be in his presence. As we saw Sunday about kids, you know, I just said we're all goofed up kids. We ask the wrong questions. Maybe we ought to rephrase our questions or get in his presence and just be so happy with his presence. We don't care what the answers are. We're asking all the wrong questions we can't get answers to. But again, Sunday we saw about kids. It said, of such is the kingdom of heaven. So maybe we ought to get in his presence as kids, and you can ask all the questions you want. You can ask him what shape is pink if you want to, or yellow or blue or whatever, but maybe we should just really think of just how awesome he is, and if he doesn't answer my question, it doesn't matter. He will one day. Maybe he doesn't want it right now because it keeps you coming back. That's what he really knows you need is his presence. So let's stand and pray. Lord, we thank you for your word, and we ask your blessing tonight as we leave. We pray that we would be filled with your Holy Spirit. We would retain the information we've learned and apply it. And Lord, bless us with safety as we go back to our homes. And Lord, I pray that we're all blessings to anybody we meet outside the church tonight or tomorrow, and put people in our path that desperately need you, people we should be praying for. And Father, have your way in our hearts. We love you, Lord, and we thank you. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.